I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. One down, two more debates to go. How did George Bush and John Kerry do last night? Well, first we're going to try to separate fact from fiction with Cece Connolly, staff writer with The Washington Post. Cece, how did they do in the truth department?
I don't think there were too many whoppers, as we like to say, but you certainly had some selective presentation of facts. You certainly had different interpretations. One that kind of stands out in my mind, President Bush has been, for a long time, as he did again last night in the debate, sort of taking credit for Libya and the improvements in relations with Libya and their weapons stockpile, when in actuality the Clinton administration had been working on those efforts and diplomacy for months, if not years.
Let's listen to what the president said.
We continue to pursue our policy of disrupting those who proliferate weapons of mass destruction. Libya has disarmed.
It would seem, too, that some close watchers would say that John Kerry lost an opportunity at that moment to point out that Muammar Gaddafi had been contained, that there had not been a war in Libya as there was a war in Iraq.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. And that would have reinforced, I think, Kerry's theme of diplomacy first. And as he kept saying, send troops as a last resort.
Let's listen to a claim that John Kerry made last night, that the war in Iraq has cost $200 billion and that the U.S. is, in effect, shouldering most of the burden.
We are 90% of the casualties and 90% of the cost. $200 billion. $200 billion that could have been used for health care, for schools.
So, Cece Connolly, talk about those numbers.
$200 billion has not been spent there. I think the realistic figure is closer to $120 billion. Certainly the estimates get you up to $200 billion. But on his broader point of the U.S. shouldering the burden financially or with troops, that's quite accurate.
Although some are pointing out today that 90% of the casualties, that doesn't account for the Iraqi casualties.
Exactly.
Let's turn to the Afghan elections. That came up. Let's listen to President Bush.
10 million people have registered to vote in Afghanistan in the upcoming presidential election.
What about that number, Cece? 10 million people registered to vote in Afghanistan.
Well, let me give a little pitch for my colleagues in the Washington Post, Glenn Kessler and Walter Pincus, and they've done some reporting with Human Rights Watch that says that that number is probably pretty inflated. But I was a little bit surprised that President Bush really wanted to bring up Afghanistan because events there in the last few weeks have gotten much worse, much more dangerous. You can certainly say that some of it is the buildup to those elections, but that situation has been more problematic for the president of late.
John Kerry had a line saying that the Bush administration had outsourced the capturing of Osama bin Laden to foreign troops. He repeatedly said that the president had allowed Osama bin Laden to escape in 2001. Let's listen.
Unfortunately, he escaped in the mountains of Tora Bora. We had him surrounded. But we didn't use American forces, the best trained in the world, to go kill him. The president relied on Afghan warlords, and he outsourced that job, too. That's wrong.
Cece Connolly, that true?
You know, partial truth, Robin. It's certainly true that our intelligence folks thought that they had a pretty good peg on bin Laden's whereabouts. Interestingly, you hear from them more the Afghan-Pakistani border. There's certainly some thought that it was a missed opportunity. On the other hand, we did not just completely outsource the job.
One last question. They did discuss North Korea, President Bush charging that Kerry's request to have direct talks with North Korea would drive China out of the coalition in the negotiations. But in fact, China has asked for direct talks with North Korea, hasn't it?
Yes, and also, as a matter of fact, and I was surprised Senator Kerry did not mention, virtually all of the other countries involved in those talks have been simultaneously holding one-on-one talks. I know you're going to talk more broadly about their presentations, but I have to say that on North Korea, Iran, Russia, I think that you really saw the depth of Senator Kerry's experience and knowledge coming out. It was striking that the challenger in this race really was able to articulate many more specifics and details than the incumbent president.
Cece Connolly, staff writer with The Washington Post. Cece, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, that's what the candidate said. How is it being received? Here's one early indicator. 53% of viewers polled by CNN said Kerry won last night's debate. 37% felt Bush did. But most pundits agreed that both men effectively crystallized their messages. John Kerry clarified in one simple sentence why he voted to authorize the president to wage a war that Kerry opposes.
I've had one position, one consistent position, that Saddam Hussein was a threat. There was a right way to disarm him and a wrong way, and the president chose the wrong way.
And George Bush was relentlessly on message about his opponent.
Mixed messages send the wrong signals to our troops. Mixed messages send the wrong signals to our allies. Mixed messages send the wrong signals to the Iraqi citizens. And that's my biggest concern about my opponent.
So who won, who lost, and how did the all-important swing state voters see it? We're joined now by editorial page editors from two states. Joe Oglesby is with the Miami Herald. Welcome, Joe.
Thank you.
And Guy McMillan writes the editorials at the Keene Sentinel in Keene, New Hampshire. Hello again, Guy.
Hi, Robin.
And first of all, just to get a sense of where you are and where you were going into last night's debate, Guy, have you endorsed, has your paper endorsed anyone yet?
We have not endorsed anybody yet, but I think it would be fair to say that we are leaning toward John Kerry.
Mm-hmm. And Joe?
We have not made our recommendation yet, but I would say that it's pretty much up in the air. Our recommendations are a product of our thinking, the editorial board, and our publisher's thinking.
Right.
And our community is quite divided on these two candidates.
So you're shopping a little. Well, it's no surprise that John Kerry is campaigning in your battleground state today, Joe. And Guy, the president is in New Hampshire and Pennsylvania today. So having said that, briefly tell us as well, who do you think won last night, Guy?
Well, I think Kerry won. I thought so last night. I think hour by hour it's becoming more and more the story of the day that Kerry really defeated Bush severely. I thought last night that he did better than Bush, but I think the two men presented opposing arguments as articulately as they possibly could, and it was much more substantive than I thought it would be. I was impressed with the debate.
And Joe?
I would agree with Guy that I was pleasantly surprised. I was not expecting much from the debate, pretty much because of all of the rules that the candidates had to follow. But I thought that there was an engagement. I thought that Kerry did come across as being more substantive, more in command of the facts. I thought that Bush was off his game somewhat. I have seen the president much better than I saw him last night, and I thought that Kerry, it was because Kerry had put him on the defensive. And I would offer this. I think that what we're dealing with here is a president who has insulated himself for the most part from the media, doesn't give press conferences very often. And then and last night, with the debate last night, we had a situation where he was hearing very up close and personal someone who was very, very critical of his policies. Mm-hmm. And I think it showed in his pained expressions.
Mm-hmm. Well, by the way, we're going to hear from someone in a few minutes who completely disagrees with your estimate of who won last night, a Bush supporter down in Crawford, Texas. But let's first listen to a chunk of tape from last night. It captures the choice before voters. It came during a question about the underlying character of both men.
But let me talk about something that the president just sort of finished up with. Maybe someone would call it a character trait, maybe somebody wouldn't. But this issue of certainty, it's one thing to be certain, but you can be certain and be wrong. It's another to be certain and be right, or be certain and be moving in the right direction, or be certain about a principle, and then learn new facts and take those new facts and put them to use in order to change and get your policy right. What I worry about with the president is that he's not acknowledging what's on the ground. He's not acknowledging the realities of North Korea. He's not acknowledging the truth of the science of stem cell research or of global warming and other issues. And certainty sometimes can get you in trouble.
30 seconds.
Well, I think, listen, I fully agree that that one should shift tactics, and we will, in Iraq. Our commanders have got all the flexibility to do what is necessary to succeed. But what I won't do is change my core values because of politics or because of pressure. And it's one of the things I've learned in the White House is that There's enormous pressure on the president, and you cannot wilt under that pressure. Otherwise, the world won't be better off.
30 seconds.
I have no intention of wilting. I've never wilted in my life. And I've never wavered in my life. I know exactly what we need to do in Iraq, and my position has been consistent. Saddam Hussein is a threat. He needed to be disarmed. We needed to go to the UN. The president needed the authority to use force in order to be able to get him to do something, because he never did it without the threat of force. But we didn't need to rush to war without a plan to win the peace.
Guy McMillan in New Hampshire. Do you think John Kerry effectively answered the questions that swing voters have about the nuances in his votes and his feelings about the war?
I think he came closer last night than he has. I think it was a good answer, not a great one. And I think the problem that John Kerry has, and any politician who wants to criticize a war while it's going on, is you can't really say this war is pointless or useless or wrong, because you've got your friends and neighbors and your children over there fighting it, and it's just unseemly to do that. On the other hand, he's got to say that he would do better. So he's in a position that is probably a little difficult.
Yeah, and Joe?
I think that's right, but keep in mind that we have the experience of Vietnam, where we have, in this country, great knowledge that sometimes our leaders can get us involved in a war that may not be good for the country. And so I think I do agree with you, Guy. I think it's a fine line that the candidates and the president has to follow here.
Yeah, but Joe, I want you to stay with that thought for a second. You mentioned President Bush's pained expressions at times, his grimaces at times, but there were also, you know, podium pounding moments.
Absolutely. I thought that the president, I was very much impressed with the president when he answered questions about Darfur, and I was impressed with his grasp of the situation there, his knowledge of the situation there. I just think that the president had an off night, that very early in the debate he did seem to be very much on the defensive, and he seemed not quite to have full command the way I have seen him in discussions previously.
You know what struck me was that the president has a tendency to assert things, while Kerry argues things, makes points, and gives reasons for things. And I think that Bush stuck way too close to his talking points last night, just repeating over and over some points that by the end of the debate you kind of wondered why he bothered. And it's obvious to people that there's trouble here, and he can't come clean on it. And he did look awkward, and I don't know why he pouts.
Some have said it's a smirk. Well, you know what? We're talking to Guy McMillan of the Keene Sentinel in New Hampshire and Joe Oglesby of the Miami Herald. Which man did look more presidential, and does that matter? How are these races going in New Hampshire and Florida, the all-important swing states? And we're also going to check in at the Spanos Coffee Station in Crawford, Texas, to find out how the debate resonated in Bush country. We'll have all of that when we come back. Stay there. You're listening to Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We're talking with Guy McMillan, editorial page editor of the Keene Sentinel in New Hampshire. Welcome back, Guy.
Thank you.
And Joe Oglesby, editorial page editor of the Miami Herald. Hi, Joe.
Hi.
And we're also going to weigh in Crawford, Texas. But before we do, I want to ask each of you, what are people around you saying about last night's debate? Guy?
I haven't heard anybody who's changed his mind. The people that are for Bush thought that he had a bad night, but they're still going to vote for Bush. And, you know, I have friends who, if John Kerry had thrown up and fallen down on the floor and started to cry last night, but still vote for him. So I don't know that these things really do change a lot of minds.
Aunt Joe?
I have just taken a quick look at some of the letters in our basket, and it seems that the Kerry people are a lot more active right now than the Bush people are, and we've got a number of responses, letters that have arrived by email congratulating Kerry for winning, and some of them even saying that they were embarrassed for the president.
Well, we know one voter in Crawford, Texas, who wouldn't say that. This morning, we thought we'd call the coffee shop in President Bush's hometown, Crawford, Texas. We asked owner Dorothy Spanos, owner of the Spanos Coffee Station, what she thought about her neighbor. And here's what she said.
I think our neighbor did wonderful, and just as we expected, he spoke from his heart, and he delivered to the public what he really and truly believed.
What did you hear in particular that you liked?
Well, of course, the one that really touched was when he talked about visiting with Mindy Johnson, the girl that had her husband had been killed.
Right. He said they prayed together and shed some tears.
They prayed together. This is the type of person he is, and this is the kind of leader he is. He's going to lead where he thinks is right, and I'm sure he spends many sleepless nights.
Well, Dorothy, what do you say? Well, first of all, a lot of people this morning are saying that maybe John Kerry did better in the debate, and your own newspaper there, is it the Iconoclast, endorsed John Kerry.
The feeling that was in the editorial that was in the Iconoclast is definitely not Crawford. The majority of the Crawford businesses have pulled their ads. You know what I think John Kerry did better is his answers to the questions were more rehearsed. President Bush doesn't deliver as well, but he practices what he feels inside.
Yeah. So Guy McMillan, sort of what you said, a Bush supporter who's still a Bush supporter, and for the reasons people have said people are Bush supporters, for his heart.
Yes, I think that the president did well last night on that account. He said some nice things about John Kerry's daughters and vice versa. Kerry's wife, and it was on the character issue, it was a nice moment, and I do think that he comes across as an ordinary person. He may have been a little more ordinary than he wanted to be last night, but I don't think it would have changed a lot of voters' minds.
And we're touching on some of the style questions, too, which I know some listeners object to that. They want it to be all about substance, but, you know, we are told by people who know about these things that people make their decisions on who looks more presidential, and there were a few things that stuck out for me. I mean, people are saying today perhaps Bush's campaign should not have demanded a podium that was as high as John Kerry's, because the end result was, John Kerry being a taller man, President Bush looked a little slumped over the podium.
He actually was slumped. This is Joe Oglesby at the Herald. He actually did slump. I thought that that was a mistake on his part to lean on the podium as he did.
I just hope there were people who were watching last night who were actually trying to follow the arguments, because I think they did a pretty good job, the two men, in explaining how they are different on the issue of Iraq and foreign policy and the terrorism question. And I think that John Kerry scored some points there, but I do think that George Bush reiterated his position that he's been stating all along, and he did it in his style, and it's a style that appeals to some people.
Right. Well, in fact, let's get back to the debate and the issues and the issue of the war in Iraq. Did George Bush justify the war? Let's listen to his response and John Kerry's to the question of whether Bush would pursue another preemptive war.
So to answer your question, I would hope we'd never have to. I think by acting firmly and decisively, it'll mean it's less likely we have to use force.
Senator Kerry, 90 seconds.
Jim, the president just said something extraordinarily revealing and frankly, very important in this debate. In answer to your question about Iraq and sending people into Iraq, he just said, the enemy attacked us. Saddam Hussein didn't attack us. Osama bin Laden attacked us.
To which President Bush responded.
First, listen. 30 seconds. Of course I know Osama bin Laden attacked us. I know that. And secondly, to think that another round of resolutions would have caused Saddam Hussein to disarm, disclose, is ludicrous in my judgment. It just shows a significant difference of opinion.
Joe Oglesby, editorial page editor for the Miami Herald in Florida. That exchange, all the others last night. What more do you need to hear to make your decision about endorsing someone?
Well, actually, let's keep in mind that the conversation last night was about foreign policy. There are many, many issues that we would make our judgment on, the economy, health care, Social Security, and any number of issues. But I think clearly the position that Kerry articulated last night is much closer to the editorial position that we have been articulating on our pages.
And Guy, I want to ask you, you know that New Hampshire is being heavily fought over. Your paper will more than likely end up endorsing John Kerry. You endorsed Howard Dean. What do you think is going to happen to the state?
I don't know. We're getting an extension on our 15 minutes of fame this year because we have four electoral votes that seem to be up for grabs. It looks as if the race has tipped a little bit toward Bush, But he won the state by only 7,000 votes in 2000, and Ralph Nader got 20,000 votes. So if you assume that the Nader vote is going to be less substantial this time, it does keep this state in play, and that's why these two men keep coming up here to visit.
And, Joe, do I dare ask what's going to happen in Florida this year?
Well, I hope that we don't have a repeat of the close contest that we had in 2000. But I think that the Florida vote will be close. I think that the president will prevail in Florida. He won here in 2000 by a mere 537 votes, and this is in a state that had millions of votes at play.
Well, we can't have...
All the votes will be counted this time.
Guy, Joe, I want to thank you both.
Thank you, Robin.
Thanks, Robin.
Guy McMillan, editorial page editor at the Keene Sentinel in Keene, New Hampshire. Joe Oglesby, editorial page editor for the Miami Herald in Florida. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Lovers of books are looking forward to Philip Roth's new offering, The Plot Against America. This Sunday's New York Times calls it a fable of fascism in red, white, and blue, and devotes 5 pages to the book, a rarity in the Times Book Review's 104-year history. But wait a minute, that review looks different. In fact, the whole book section looks just a little different. To talk about the highly anticipated books this fall and the long-awaited new book section, we're joined by Sam Tannenhaus. He's the new New York Times Book Review editor. Hello.
Hi.
Well, let's talk about this new look because, you know, there was a lot of anticipation way back in, I think, January. The Pointer Online, which writes about journalism and such, speculated that the New York Times might be doing less fiction books and more nonfiction books and maybe succumbing to a trend.
Yes, there was a lot of prognosticating going on in all corners, and I can understand how some of that happened, partly because the trends in book publishing now do seem to favor nonfiction over fiction, and because my own background was as a nonfiction writer, so I could see where the questions were raised. But in fact, this has been an extraordinary season for fiction, for the novel in particular, and we're a book review that tries to keep its finger on the pulse of the literary world, and Philip Roth's novel, among others, really stands out as an important piece of fiction.
So, phew, you're not going to be all Bill O'Reilly and Michael Moore all the time.
No. Our nonfiction bestseller list looks that way sometimes, but fiction matters a great deal to us. And this is also a moment I think we're realizing when a certain kind of novel, not to put too narrow a focus on it, seems to speak to the political and cultural atmosphere. And Roth's novel is a classic example of that.
Well, let's talk about that. The review starts on the front cover, which is unusual. It's only happened a few times that I've noted. And the book is getting just so much press. Can you synopsize what it's about?
Philip Roth posits that the 1940 presidential election resulted in a victory not for FDR, Franklin Roosevelt, but in fact for Charles Lindbergh, who was running as the tribune of American first isolationism, opposed to getting involved in World War II. And of course, Lindbergh was also known notoriously at the time for kind of flirtation with Nazi Germany. And Roth imagines what America would have been like, in particular, what the circumstances of his own actual family of Jews living in a part of Newark would have experienced day to day had there actually been a Lindbergh presidency.
Paul Berman wrote your review. He's author of Terror and Liberalism, an observer of American foreign policy. He writes about Philip Roth's book, it's sinister, vivid, dreamlike, preposterous, and at the same time, creepily plausible. It can happen here, sort of.
Yeah, that's right. That's a brilliant description by Paul. But he's right, because what makes Roth's novel so remarkable is that he is able to take this very large and even abstract historical premise and filter it through the lives of very ordinary people. So you see the impact day to day. And as Paul says, it's creepy because you see the creeping spread of a kind of nativist American fascism. And it's realized, presented with such conviction and such minute attention to detail that it begins to seem like something that really might have happened.
Well, with your finger on the pulse there at the New York Times Book Review, what other books do you see on the horizon?
Well, I'll tell you, next Sunday we're going to have another novel on the cover. And this is a novel called War Trash by the Chinese-American novelist Ha Jin. And again, this is a novel that's told in the form of a memoir. This time the past is the Korean War. And Ha Jin's narrator imagines being a Chinese prisoner of war who is caught between the conflicting forces of Chinese nationalists, of communist Chinese, and his American captors. Mm-hmm. And again, it's a novel that is about a specific moment in the past that seems to speak to our current anxieties. It's a powerful, brilliant novel reviewed by Russell Banks, important novelist himself, who calls it a masterpiece in our pages.
How does this happen, by the way? I mean, Ha Jin is a National Book Award winner. He wrote Waiting, right?
That's right.
But how does it happen? Do you sift through all these books, or do you just sit there and salivate and wait for Ha Jin's book and know it's going to be great? How does he get on the cover?
It's a combination of factors. We do look at all the books as they come in, and of course we're particularly aware of books by prominent writers, though we take care not to feature them at the expense of new writers or less famous ones. But it's really a kind of dynamism or convergence of interest. If a book strikes us as interesting and we put it in the hands of a reviewer who really responds to what's happening on the page and is able to convey that in an exciting piece, we think we have, in our own terms, news.
Okay, other books you've told us to look for. Nora Roberts' Snow is coming out. Stephen King has a book coming out. Tom Wolfe?
Yes, well, we haven't seen Tom Wolfe's novel yet. Now, the book review actually ran a very brief excerpt from it. Apparently, he's finishing it now. Mm-hmm. He's an old-time journalist and apparently likes the idea of writing to deadline, but we've not seen that manuscript yet.
So it's highly
coming out in the fall.
Highly anticipated.
Yeah.
From the author of Bonfire of the Vanities. And just taking a look at the nonfiction list, it is a political year, so of course there are going to be many political books. You've got a review of Jon Stewart's book, America, the Book, in the issue coming out this Sunday.
We do.
Kitty Kelly's book, how are you treating that?
We're reviewing it at some length. It's an important book in its own terms. Now, it doesn't mean that there aren't questions to be raised about her method of investigation and her sourcing. Mm-hmm. But what's interesting about this book is its sweep, that she really has gathered up all the strands of the Bush dynasty, a phrase that might not have occurred to us a decade ago, but here it is. And she covers the entire history of the Bush family and their political rise. Now, we've given it to a reviewer, Ted Widmer, who's both a historian and a journalist, who has a feel for where Kitty Kelly's kind of insidery, gossipy approach to narrative meets the sterner tests of carefully researched history. And it's that tension that he describes in his review.
Sam Tannenhaus, before we let you go, we note that you're going to have a new feature called Inside the List. It'll be to the left of the bestseller list. It'll explain the list a bit, give a little history. I'm wondering, are you still going to point out the books that have been bought in bulk order, which some interpret as meaning that, you know, maybe the author or someone close to the author has bought a whole bunch of those books and pushed it onto the bestseller list?
Yes, the list will indicate that. And it may be at some point in our continuing coverage, our column called TBR Inside the List, which is to the left only physically, not ideologically, of the bestseller list, will raise certain points, explain certain features of the bestseller list, and not just of our own bestseller list, but really try to report trends in reading across the country. And as we get that column more underway, readers will see interesting items, we hope, every week.
I hope that one of the trends is that people are reading.
Well, we'll see.
And I know you do, too. Sam Tannenhaus, the New York Times Book Review editor, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you.
See, you got the new biography. Where did they get the info from? Same as before, some so-called friend who claimed to have known me then.
You're listening to Here and Now.
Well, I can't even remember last week. Got to question where they're coming from. What knowledge of it is me that they speak so far away?
We have a correction and a quick check on what you're thinking. Our conversation with Tom Nastic of the new National Archive Movie Theater prompted Steve McKenna of Maynard, Massachusetts, to call with this correction.
Robin asked him if it was possible that someone could walk in and ask for a recording of JFK talking to members of the Warren Commission, and he answered that that was possible. I would really like to hear that, given that the Warren Commission was founded to investigate the assassination of JFK. There's a scoop we might have missed for the last 40-some odd years.
Yes, well, obviously neither of us was paying attention. I intended to ask about LBJ's conversations with members of the Warren Commission. And after yesterday's preview of the presidential debates, which included a conversation about the importance of style, we heard from Lorna Bratton, who writes, I really have to wonder about the intelligence of the electorate. Today I learned that Kerry must smile more and that Bush must appear to be less boyish, but not too much less. Apparently these factors have a crucial impact on the election. Truly, we have the government we deserve. As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and town. Commuters try all kinds of things to make their train trip to work more enjoyable. They read, they talk on cell phones, or they listen to music on iPods. But in the Japanese train system, the train itself makes the music. Producer Andy Raskin has the story.
Here's what it sounds like at Tokyo's Shinagawa Station before the Keihin Tohoku line leaves the platform. Here's Tokyo Station, the Yamanote Line. And Yoyogi, the Sobu Line. When I was a student in Japan in 1988, a shrill beeping noise used to signal all aboard. But on a recent business trip to Tokyo, I found the platforms there alive with the sound of synthesized music. A Japan railway spokesman told me the idea is to alleviate the kind of commuter anxiety that drives passengers to jam themselves into already crowded trains. In the early 1990s, the railroad commissioned Yamaha to write a Hassha Melody, or departing train melody, that would be as attention-getting as a 2 kilohertz siren, without provoking jitters. A Yamaha composer was supposedly walking into a Zen temple when he noticed that the sound of its iron bell was penetrating yet soothing. He programmed the first Hassha melody to exhibit a similar timbre. Like highway signage, Hassha melodies are about function, yet they're often quite beautiful. In Funabashi Station, for instance, people board the Sobu line to the beat of a regal, futuristic waltz. There is drama on the Joban line at Abiko Station. In Shinjuku, on the Saikyo line, there's what might be an ode to Mr. Rogers' trolley. When two trains arrive at the same station, the result can be eerie dissonance. Judging from the rush hour pushing and shoving I saw, the phrase, "let's wait for the next one," has yet to catch on in Tokyo. But I'm glad for the hasha melodies, if only because they add an interesting dimension to a regular old train ride. And my favorite of all is the Keio line at Tokyo Station. You don't have to look around at all the smiling kids wearing big black ears to know that you're bound for a land of fun and happiness where all your dreams come true. You don't need the conductor to tell you that after the lady's voice says all aboard, the doors are closing. You're going to Tokyo Disneyland.
Our survey of the musical All Aboard sounds of the Japanese railway system was produced by Andy Raskin. Stay with us. There's more ahead here. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We have this note on our top story today. U.S. polls from CNN and CBS show that respondents felt Senator John Kerry was a more impressive debater than President Bush in last night's debate, the first of three for the two men. Early reports show that debate received a 37.7 rating and was watched by an estimated 55 million television viewers here in the U.S., up from the year 2000, when the Bush-Gore debate averaged a 31 rating and reached 46 million viewers. And the U.S. presidential debate attracted a lot of attention overseas. Many Europeans stayed up past 4 a.m. to see the whole debate. And because of the time difference, Asian viewers stayed home from work to catch it this morning. You may think you have problems finding the right shoe, but how about prima ballerinas, whose pink satin toe shoes are often handmade for them by craftsmen using old-world techniques? And the shoes still aren't just right. Anna Pavlova, who danced at the turn of the 20th century and is still one of the world's best-known ballerinas, used to rip apart her shoes and reassemble them to make them just so. And Margot Fonteyn apparently quieted the noise her shoes made by smashing them on the stairs. Well, on a recent trip to London, Here and Now's Lynn Menegon saw how point shoes are made and how one ballerina at the Royal Ballet, Leanne Benjamin, destroys them.
I'm quite obsessive about my shoes. Tell me why.
I'm sick about them, actually. Because when I have the perfect shoe, I'll have the perfect show.
Have you ever had the perfect shoe?
Occasionally. More not than often, shall I say. The worst I've had is that I did a filming of Coppelia live several years ago, and I wasn't supposed to do the filming, and the girl went off on the day, and my shoes were probably a little bit old, and the shoe came off the heel in one of my solos, and I had to do the whole solo, and it was live performance. It didn't show, but I kept going, but I mean, that's like your nightmare.
So you get the call to do Coppelia live, and you're thinking...
The only thing you're thinking is shoes. Well, apart from, I have a million people watching in the audience, you know, live on BBC. But the first thing to me will be, what shoes will I wear? Because they're handmade, you know, they're all going to feel different. So that, you know, we'd actually, in this case, like a machine, but... you know, just to make them all like a production line.
My name is Patrick Cornelius. I'm the factory manager at Fried of London. The point shoe is made by an individual man, not by a team. We have 25 different craftsmen, some of whom have been making this type of shoe for more than 40 years. We produce in the order of 5,000 pairs a week, and they go all over the world. We're standing now in front of a maker called Raymond. Raymond has a symbol that he puts on his shoe, which is a crown. Each maker has an identifying symbol or letter to show that he made the shoes, because the point shoe is ordered by the maker. The maker is very important to the individual dancer. Some dancers will have been using shoes made by the same men for most of their dancing life. The shoe is in fact made inside out. Looking at the shoe the right way, there's a layer of satin. There are two layers of a thin cotton. And into those two layers, three layers, we place burlap, a heavy paper which goes in a moist condition and spread with a paste. At the end of the day, we bake them in that oven there for 12 hours at a low heat.
You don't burn the satin.
That's right.
So the hardened point of the shoe is really layers upon layers of material and glue.
That's correct. For the professional dancer, we know that they're not going to last much longer than one performance. This is Taksim. Taksim is the maker for Leon Benjamin at the Royal Ballet Company.
Where are you from?
I'm from Cyprus. Anka is my own personal symbol.
So it means on the bottom of the sole, on the leather, on the bottom of the shoe, there's a symbol of an anchor.
Yes.
Now, do you ever go and see the ballet?
I never been ballet.
Have you met Leanne Benjamin?
No.
She's right here in London. You're holding a pair of shoes that she will get to know intimately.
Okay.
And there you are, making them, and you're right in the same city, and you haven't met?
I never met, you know, because, you know, we're making lots of production in here, and then lots of performance and lots of shoes.
Good afternoon, Royal House, stage door.
For some reason, I haven't met this particular maker, but he does a lot for my shoes. I've had to change my shoes quite a lot since coming back from pregnancy, as you can imagine. I mean, if you went down and had a look at my place downstairs, well, mine is just shoes. Someone will come and look at this, my bench, and go, my God, and I will know exactly which shoes will be fine and which won't be, you know. I'll have the shoes that I know I can only wear for rehearsal. I wouldn't be seen dead on them on the stage. And then, you know, your performance shoes, which you might, say, have 10 pairs on your place for, and you might find two or three that are good out of that pile for that particular performance. To start with, I get a fresh pair of shoes. I will shellac the shoes once, maybe twice, on the inside of the shoe, just to give it an extra bit of support, because it's like a cake, almost. It's actually like a cake. When it's come out of the oven, it's soft, more pliable. So basically, you don't want to wear your shoes straight from the factory. You actually want to let them settle in a little bit to harden themselves up. Before I wear them the first time, I will bend the back up. Yeah?
Oh, that beautiful shoe.
Yeah, they completely get destroyed now. I will just bang under the sole. Is anyone out there? You want to bang under the sole just to take away that noise. What I do is open the door and put the shoe...
In the hinge.
In the hinge and close the door slightly. So that's softening the toe and just spreading the shoe out a little in the toe area.
And this is the only way that the shoe really works for you.
Yes, and it looks like we've just bought them and popped them on.
Far from it.
And far from it.
Do you ever get the point in the day where you've done massive amounts of rehearsing and you look at your shoes and you go, oh, God, I've got to do my shoes. It's like time to make the donuts.
Yeah, you wear them out often quicker than you've spent to prepare shoes. And that's the tragedy of it all.
Do you ever want to encase the perfect shoe in a glass and measure them and photograph them and send them back to the maker and say, please?
Yes, I've done that before, but, you know, it just never happens. It just no two shoes feel the same.
Our visit to Freed of London was produced by Here Now's Lynn Menegon. And Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Get into your radio, have a great weekend, and join us again, Here and Now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.